Tories with Greatest Foe. Before that, the Nines with Melanie. And we started that set off with the Goldbergs and Feel the Sun. That is just about going to do it for this edition of Breakfast for Dinner. This is DJ Chris Wired. I want to thank you for joining me. As a reminder, this show is rebroadcast on Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. here in WRCT Pittsburgh. So you can check it either on Sunday nights at 11 or Thursday afternoons at 1, whatever suits your fancy, I guess. Anyway, we are going to close the show out tonight with Phish. This is off of one of their live Phish CDs, specifically the November 2nd, 1996, at the Coral Sky Amphitheater in West Palm Beach, Florida. Originally off their Wanta album. We're going to play Fee. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in again next time.
I'll make you lose your grip. With this tiny piece of paper, I can make you slip. So Millie took that paper and did the deed. Floyd hit the water with astonishing speed. And as the shark circled in and began to feed, Millie knew the weasel was finally free.
That's completely free. Floyd is dead, he's nothing but a man. Cause Millie took that paper and sliced him on the nipple. Oh, oh, fee. Trying to live a life that's completely free. Floyd is dead, he's nothing but a ripple. Cause Millie took that paper and sliced him on the nipple. So have a cup of coffee and catch your breath. Whoa, we're trying to live a life that's completely free. You're racing with the wind, you're flirting with death. So have a cup of coffee and catch your breath.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito.
In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I walk for miles along the highway. Well, that's just my way of saying I love you. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I stop to see a weeping willow.
Help me, I'm falling in love with you. Close the door to turn away from me, darling. I'm begging you to please help me. I'm falling in love with you.
Saginaw, Michigan. I grew up and our house in Saginaw Bay. My dad was a poor, hard-working Saginaw fisherman. Too many times he came home with too little pay. I love the girl,
I love the girl
in Saginaw, Michigan.
Saginaw, Michigan.
The daughter of a wealthy, wealthy man. But he called me that son of a Saginaw fisherman, and not good enough to claim his daughter's hand. Now I'm up here in Alaska, looking around for gold. Like a crazy fool, I'm a digging in this frozen grounds of coal. But with each new day, I pray I'll strike it rich, and then I'll go back home and claim my love in Saginaw, Michigan.
I wrote my love
in Saginaw, Michigan.
Saginaw, Michigan.
I said, honey, I'm coming home, please wait for me. And you can tell your dad I'm coming back a richer man. I hit the biggest track in Klondike history.
Her dad met me
in Saginaw, Michigan.
Saginaw, Michigan.
He gave me a great big party with champagne. Then he said, son, you're wise, young, ambitious man. Will you sell your father in a lawyer Klondike claim? Now he's up there in Alaska, digging in the cold, cold ground. The greedy fool is looking for the gold I never found. It serves him right, and no one here is missing him, least of all the newlyweds of Saginaw, Michigan. For the happiest man and wife in Saginaw, Michigan. He's ashamed to show his face in Saginaw, Michigan.
Well, I never felt more like singing a blues, 'cause I never thought that I'd ever lose your love. You, why'd you do me this way? Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine, the dream is gone I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go? 'Cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues. I'd ever lose your love, dear. Why'd you do me this way? Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine, the dream is gone I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go?
cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues.
Sit a high, getting ideas. Ain't nothing but a fool to live like this. Out all night, running wild. Woman sitting home with a month-old child. Dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? Just sitting around drinking with the rest of the guys. Six rounds bought and I bought five. Spent the groceries and half the rent. Like $14 having 27 cents. So dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? They say roses are red and violets are purple, and sugar's sweet and so is maple syrup. And I'm the seventh out of seven sons. My pappy was a pistol, I'm a son of a gun. I said, dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
Lord, preserve us and protect us. Mando Richard has Whiskey Before Breakfast. Tune in to WRCT's Folk and Bluegrass Show, Whiskey Before Breakfast. Wednesdays at 11 a.m., you'll hear a wide range of folk music, traditional and contemporary fiddle tunes and songs galore. Be sure to catch WRCT's Whiskey Before Breakfast at 11 a.m. Wednesdays, right here on 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, or streaming WRCT.org.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but mama tried. A one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried. Mama tried, mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried. Mama tried, mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried.
If I see you tomorrow, saw the street in town. Pardon me if I don't say hello. I belong to another. It wouldn't look so good to know someone I'm not supposed to know. Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. In a dimly lit corner at a place outside of town, tonight we'll try to say goodbye again.
Goodbye.
But I know it's not over. I'll call tomorrow night. I can't let you go, so why pretend? Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet.
You've painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Ruby, are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadow on the wall tells me the sun is going down. Started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And yes, it's true that I'm not the man I used to be. Some company. It's hard to love a man whose legs are bent and paralyzed. And the wants and the needs of a woman your age, Ruby, I realize. But it won't be long, I've heard them say, until I'm not around. Your love to town. She's leaving now, 'cause I just heard the slamming of the door. The way I know I've heard it slam 100 times before. And if I could move, I'd get my gun and put her in the ground. Take your love to town. For God's sakes, turn around.
I
I can almost hear the stillness as it yields to the sound of your heart beating. Bum, bum, bum. And I can almost hear the echo of the thoughts that I know you must be thinking. Bum, bum, bum. And I can feel your body tremble as you wonder what this moment holds in store. Bum, bum, bum. And as I put my arms around you, I can tell you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know what I'm saying as my trembling fingers touch forbidden places. Bum, bum, bum. I only know I've waited for so long for the chance that we are taking. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know and I don't care what made you tell him you don't love him anymore. Bum, bum, bum. And as I taste your tender kisses, I can tell you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. And as I take the love you're giving, I can feel tension building in your mind.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
And you're wondering if tomorrow I'll still love you like I'm loving you tonight.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
You have no way of knowing, but tonight will only make me love you more. And I hope that you'll believe me, 'cause I know you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
John Talley had a big crap game going back in the alley, and I kept rolling them seven and winning all them pots. My luck was so good I could do no wrong. I just kept on rolling and controlling them bones. Finally they just threw up their hand and said, when you hot, you hot. I said, yeah.
When you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not.
Put all the money in and let it roll again.
When you're hot, you're hot.
Just getting ready to roll them again when I heard something behind me. I turned around and there was a big old cop. He said, hello, boy. Then he gave us a grin and said, look like I'm gonna have to haul y'all in and keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot.
He said, yeah, when you're hot, hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can explain it all down at City Hall. I said, yeah, when you're hot, hot, you're hot. In the court, I couldn't believe my eyes. The judge was a fishing buddy that I recognized. I said, hey, judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you hot, you hot. And I said, thanks a lot.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You let my friends go free and throw the book at me. He said, well, when you're hot, you're hot. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing, judge, old buddy, old pal.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Plastercaster, and I always listen to WRCT when I'm in Pittsburgh because only talented people are played on the station.
So I wanted to talk to you all a little bit about conceptualizing spirituality in Black faith communities and the cultural schemas that exist around prayer, illness, and healing. But first, let me tell you just a little bit about myself. So I was raised in the Midwest by a family that pretty much migrated from the South. And so I was raised in a very firm Southern Christian Baptist faith, very traditional. My grandfather was a deacon in the church. My grandmother was a mother in the church. I was a junior nurse. I was in the junior choir. We went to church every Sunday, most Wednesdays and some Saturdays. And as a matter of fact, in my household, if you didn't go to church on Sunday, there really wasn't much else you could do the rest of the week. It was off limits. Growing up in the church really did instill in me a lot of the lessons that have given me the strength to be the woman that I am today. What I learned very early in that setting was that God heals us. Prayer heals us. And those messages were bountiful throughout the church. I could recite Psalms that kind of speak to that. If you think about Psalm 147:3, it tells us that God heals the brokenhearted. He binds up our wounds. I can remember my earliest testimony. I was maybe 9 or 10, and I had a situation where I was getting ready to go somewhere, and in the Midwest, we have basements. I know that's not something that you guys have, mostly in Texas, but we were a working class family, so we had an unfinished basement. I was going down the stairs, and I tripped. Right before I hit what would have been the concrete floor, my foot caught on the railing. That was God. I went to church, I went to Sunday school, we prayed about it, and everyone talked about what a good Christian kid I was and how I was saved, and that my prayer is what healed me that day. Sometimes the spoken and unspoken messages in the church is that if you're strong, of good faith, and you lean not unto your own understanding, and definitely not the understanding of others, then God will save you and heal you. However, what I've learned over time is that that message can sometimes incapacitate Black women's ability to seek help when they need it. I remember very vividly a story of a woman that I was working with once, collecting data, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And she belonged to the Kojic faith, so the Church of God in Christ. She recounted to me the story of how she went to church after her diagnosis had been revealed, and they tried an exorcism on her to remove the bipolar disorder from her, and how damaging that experience was for her. This is not uncommon when you think about the conflict in spirituality between faith communities and mental health recovery. For African American women, and for most Black women, we are held to these cultural stereotypes, these tropes. I'm sure some of you have heard of them. The superwoman, where we can do anything and everything all the time, perfectly, oftentimes at a consequence to ourselves. There's also the trope of the mammy, where we are the nurturer. Come to us with your troubles, talk to us, we will listen to you and take care of you. If you're in our family, if you're in our community, if you're outside of both of those things, our arms are always open and welcome. You probably also have heard about the sapphire. This is this angry Black woman who has this unbridled anger, who's enraged all of the time. these tropes that kind of circle around our own community impact Black women specifically, because we spend a good deal of time either trying to counter all of those narratives, we're none of those things. We try very much so to own each of those different pieces of ourself, or we try to navigate and find a way to vacillate between those different narratives. I am this or I'm not this. And it can be exhausting. It can cause some significant mental health distress. These challenges with our mental health histories for Black women, oftentimes because we serve in those roles with consequence to ourselves, it costs us our own mental health. We don't seek out the services and support that we need to. And our faith then tells us that we shouldn't need to seek out these outside pieces of support because God will heal us. He is there for us. Prayer will save us. As I evolved as a Black woman and as a Christian, I started to notice the conflict between these two areas. My work when I provided clinical services to individuals, my research working with women with severe mental illnesses, has told me that this is not sustainable. So there has to be some type of other options. What is it that we can do where we can maintain whatever our spiritual grounding is and tells us, but also find ways to seek out support and services where we need it? That tells us, hey, go to the medical community. Seek out some forms of treatment. When God alone isn't saving you and you're still experiencing your mental illnesses, then that's the option, right? But what we know from the research is that cultural mistrust is real. We understand historically that the medical community has used Black bodies without their consent and abused that use to advance medical technology. Those advances sometimes have often reinforced the systematic oppression that has occurred for Black people. So the medical community is not always our first option, a trusted option for us to seek out. There's a conflict there. If our spirituality isn't serving us, and if the medical community, we're just not sure if they will serve us, what do we do? Where do we go? How do we address these issues that we're facing that move a little bit beyond the blues? We know that women experience mental health issues 50% times more than their male counterparts. But we also know for all of those people who express having psychological distress that Black women tend to seek help 50% less than their white female counterparts. So we are out here with the exact same level of psychological distress, needing the exact same supports and services. If we're like the former person I mentioned that I interviewed, not able to seek it out from our faith community, if you're familiar with what happens in medicine, not able to seek it out from the medical community, and we're at a little bit of a loss on how we travel this path to recovery. Most of us aren't even aware that there is an option for mental health recovery. We resolve that this is our path, this is our state, this is where we need to be, and we toil through it. Oftentimes you'll hear Black women say something, "I'm just making it through." And that is our superwoman trope at play. That is our way of saying that we're going to continue on this path that we are, with or without help, because we just don't know where to go and because we know it's what we do. On one hand, that demonstrates excellent resilience, and I think that that is a key characteristic for a lot of Black women. On the other hand, when we do finally seek assistance, we're at a point where our symptomology is more severe and more acute and more chronic and has had more negative impact than what we would have seen had we sought services earlier on. So how do we bend this together? How do we blend all of these different aspects of what we need, these conflicts in our healing, this conflict in our spirituality? What do? We have to start to think about how we present narrative. What's the conversation surrounding mental health and recovery in Black communities, specifically for women? How do we balance out? Sometimes I am a little bit of a superwoman. Sometimes I'm a little bit of a sapphire too, and that's okay. But when I know that I need help, there's a resource there for me. We need to find a way to get our faith community to stop pathologizing and demonizing mental illnesses. At the same time, we need to get our treatment communities to stop pathologizing and demonizing our spiritual histories. The conversation has to happen simultaneously. Now, it's not to say that there hasn't been efforts in this. There have been. If you look at the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, they've partnered with Black faith communities and other faith communities to develop what's called NAMI FaithNet. And this is a great resource directed towards spiritual leaders to give them the language to talk about severe and persistent mental illnesses in the church. Black churches are very okay with talking about depression and anxiety because we all get the blues. We all get a little riled up. But when you start talking about bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, they're a little bit silent. Our therapeutic communities are very open to looking at some of this change. NAMI, a national organization for mentally ill, has also partnered with Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated to start to bring the conversation into the Black female communities so that we can have these larger conversations. But what happens when we go to therapy and when we say we were talking to our grandmother about what we've been experiencing? Or we were talking to God out loud and having a conversation? That sometimes is pathologized. And so there has to be a way to have both of these communities, both of these sides, figure out how to have different conversations. I recently attended a training for work that talked about crucial conversations. There's a book out about that now. Some of you have probably heard about it. It's fairly popular. It's a new way to kind of have difficult dialogues. And I think when we talk about faith and mental health recovery for Black women, that's a difficult dialogue. That training was a day-long training. I can't remember a lot of what happened because it was exhausting. But one thing stuck with me from that day, and that was the use of the word and. When you have a conversation, when you're in a disagreement, don't say yes, but, say yes, and. And that somehow really resonated with me, thinking about how do we blend together faith, my spirituality, and my need for mental health resources. Even when I think about my own path and my own mental health history and seeking out services, I remember how shy I was about talking to my family about it. I remember the discussion when my mother found out I was in counseling and what she thought about that. But I think what was missing for me, even to articulate it to her, was the and. Me seeking out treatment doesn't mean that I wasn't also praying. I definitely was. If we can focus the conversation on and, you can pray, you can have your spiritual depth, you can walk your spiritual walk, and you can seek out treatment, and you can take medication, because that's a big step for a lot of people in the Black faith community. You can do both of those things simultaneously and remain in allegiance to who you are as a person, who you are as a spiritual being, while you are allowing God to provide the resources that are available to you to heal you. So for all of you here, for the people who are practitioners, when you're talking to Black women about mental health and recovery, talk about the and. Figure out how to infuse their spirituality into the work that you're doing. If you're a faith leader and you're talking with someone who's struggling with a mental health challenge or a significant and persistent mental illness, provide the options for them to seek treatment while you pray with them. If you're just a friend or a spouse or a peer of someone who is struggling with the balance of what do I do with my faith when I sit down or I take my Xanax or I talk to a doctor or I tell someone secrets of my family, tell them they can do both. You can be spiritual. You can walk that walk. You can take your medication. You can treat your illness and you can recover.
I went to Vietnam in late 68, early 69. I was a little over 18, couldn't wait to get there.
I was going to A Company 501st Aviation Battalion. This is September 1965.
I was in the 559th Squadron, and I flew 201 missions there in combat.
People always, when they want to get you in a corner and talk about Vietnam, I said, you don't have enough time today for me to sit down and tell you all the experiences that I had in Vietnam. The day that I got 25 holes in my ship, I said, and the instrument panel was shot out. Just when I got short and I was showing a new pilot how to make a gun run and a bullet comes up and goes straight through between my legs, I said, you don't have time for me to tell you about that.
I learned how to visually track the enemy constantly, night, day, through rain, through water, through triple canopy jungles, ocean. And along with that training, they sent you through dog handler schools, combat tracker team. A lot of people totally forgot about that we were the first to make contact with the enemy.
I attended Howard University and was commissioned through that source. From there, I went to pilot training.
I went home after my sophomore year and I told my dad that I was wasting his money and my time. A week later, I was in the United States Army.
Well, I joined the military being surrounded by Marines, Navy, and of course, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. And it was a fascinating thing to see those people in uniform. And to watch people jump out of an airplane was just something that just took the breath away from you. I couldn't wait to get that age when my parents would give me permission to join the military. And I immediately checked airborne.
I knew I was going into the Air Force to fly. I graduated in the upper 10% of my class, so I had a choice. You know, bombers or fighters. So I chose fighters, which I always wanted to fly, because the Tuskegee Airmen was my influence.
I went through basic training. I was the outstanding graduate of that brigade.
I'm one of the first 11 black African-American students to walk at an all-white school in 1968.
When I graduated from OCS, I went to airborne school right after that. And then after airborne school, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I was an XO in a basic training company, and then they switched me over to become an instructor.
When I left the ROTC program at Tuskegee as the Commandant of Cadets, I was sort of looking for a job. Now, it turned out that my former boss, Frank K. Evers, he was the commander of that training wing of F-4s. And sure enough, he hired me as an instructor to go out at Davis-Monthan in the 4453rd wing, the 4456 squadron.
Eventually, you know, you get enough time and you go on enough combat assaults and you go on enough ash and trash, you become an aircraft commander. And I did that.
I had some very, very good instructors and leaders to say, go do it. Don't let nothing hold you back, because being raised in the South, you always had that fear. Well, should I get in it or should I not get in it? And I must say I had white instructors and leaders that pushed me to all the way to where I am today.
Left Davis-Monthan in November of 66. From there, I went to Cameron Bay.
We were up near the Cambodian border in 25th Division, and we had gone up there to support them, and they were in heavy contact. I mean heavy, heavy contact. And the CNC ship, the command and control ship up there, called me and said that they're running out of ammunition. And would you go down and resupply them? Whenever I was going to put my crew in danger like that, I always talked to them, and I said, what do you guys think? I said, let's go. And so we went and got the ammunition, and we got, boom, turned around, boom, came out. Not a hole in the aircraft.
Not a hole in the aircraft.
Okay, flew back up. Billy joined on me again. And then the CNC ship asked me the second time. He said, we have some people down there that are severely wounded. He said, if you don't go and get them, he said, they're going to die. This time, the guys were ready for me on the other end up there. And they started shooting at me. And I told the guys, get them in here, get them in here, get them. And I looked over my shoulder, and they must have put pressure on one of the guys, because he was, I mean, the blood was just coming out very thick. Anyway, they fired an RPG at me, and it missed. Anyway, I told Billy to stay out of the area, Billy Miller. And Billy went right over the top of me, and I saw his aircraft wobble. He got hit. He got hit, personally. And the other two guys that we took back survived. Years later, Billy and I were both colonels at the time, and Billy was down at Fort Bragg, and we were at the officers club. And I said, Billy, you remember that day that I told you to stay out of the area? And you flew overhead and you got shot? He said, oh, yeah, I remember. I said, remember I told you not to come in the area? You know what he told me? He said, Larry, he said, I saw the fire that you were taking. He said, I couldn't stay out there like that. And Billy was white. I didn't give a crap what he was. You know, he was my friend.
You don't really know the character and the quality of the people you're working with till you get in combat. And then you really know who they are.
When an aircraft went down, everybody came. When I went down, my second tour. I wasn't shot down. I lost an engine. I was on the ground for about 30, 40 minutes. But Jesus, I had all the help. And they had, I never forget, the two F-100s that came and started circling around. And they put a slick in there and picked me up.
They were solid citizens. You could count on everybody in my squadron, and I'm sure the other squadrons as well, to do what they were required to do.
You get closer to war dogs than you do to your own house and family dog, because you know the value of that dog. The first tour, I got shot up real bad. I was with the 101st Airborne, and I was called out with the 1st, the 187th, and they had received enemy fire, and they had ambush, and of course, we jumped right on the mission. You don't ask no questions, you just go. Now me, my dog rappelled with me because he had got so used to the harnesses that we had made for him. We call it jerry-rigged. And once he get that harness, he knew he was coming out of a helicopter. Immediately, I put the dog on the trail. The jungle got so thick, so they sent a person with me with a machete. Even though the dog could go under, they needed to cut that area where I could walk through, which was quite dangerous. As we went, I don't know how many kilometers it was at that time. I would say a couple of clicks, because it was like 3 or 4 hours. My dog alerted. I told the commander, I said, well, this is my dog is alerted. It's time that I turn the mission over to you now and let your people move forward, because it's just the dog and I. We're out front 150 yards or meters or whatever it was. His words was to, I want a KIA, and our mission was to get one. And I don't want you to pull off this mission. So Ben is, as a good soldier, I continued the mission. Now, what I did do was put the dog behind me and put him on a shorter leash, because I had him on originally 25-foot leash. Labradors did not bark, did not make sounds unless their handler was really, really in danger. So he barked twice, and I knew that was trouble. Well, as I turned to signal that it's really bad up front, it just opened up. And all I know that I was trying to protect that dog. That was my main thing. And I was able to push the dog away from me. When I did, I got hit in both legs.
My first mission was a Sunday morning. We fanned out, the three of us. And when I rolled in, as soon as I was leveled out with the target and was ready to pickle, I saw something in front of me, a big boiling black thing that turned red, you know, fire. So I started jinking away from my initial track and reacquired the target. And as I pulled off, most guys break left. I broke right. And sure enough, the explosion had tracked me to go that way. And then coming back home, we were all white. That's right.
After getting out of the hospital, I started going to leadership schools. Being a weapons person, I was in charge of all the weapons. All the college kids that came through ROTC, right out of college, my job was to teach them to shoot properly, and also to dress properly. So one day, I come by, my first sergeant said, here's a copy of your orders. And I said, well, where am I going? He said, back to Vietnam.
I rolled in on the target. I had a three-ship aircraft, a three-ship formation. And I rolled in on the target. I had 650-pound bombs, and I pickled my bombs off and pulled off the target. And as soon as I pulled off the target, my right wing dipped, which made me know that my right rack didn't go off. So I put it in burner and did a big whiff-a-dill while my other two guys were on the target. And when I came back down, I released my three. But then I felt this bump, whoom. And I said, gee whiz, that must be some jet wash. Okay, from the other two aircraft. So we go out to the tanker, and it was supposed to be a silent refueling. And the boom operator broke silence and said, F4 in its pre-contact position, you have right part of your right wing missing. And it was a hole in that dihedral about like so. And what had happened, an 85 millimeter round went right through that dihedral. It didn't explode. It was not fused correctly. And therefore, I wound up with a big hole rather than a destroyed aircraft.
My second tour of duty, I was in military intelligence, and I was a door gunner for the commander of the aviation.
Being in combat is unusual. Most human beings never go through that. And I defy anybody to say they came back the same way they were.
I became a real leader over there. I became a real aviator over there, where my skills were put to the test on a daily basis.
You go to war at young age, you mature very quickly, and then you come back, you expect open arms. Oh, it was not true.
And when I came back, I wasn't spit on, but I was looked at in disdain.
That was the time when all the draft dodgers were against us for going to Vietnam. They treated us like animals. And we come into the airport, and they was up on a ramp, and they threw feces on us, they threw beer on us, they threw beer cans at us. You kill babies, I mean, they just gave us a they gave us a wreck over that you wouldn't. It was the worst homecoming that you can ever believe. And when a soldier tell you that, it is definitely true. And that was in April 1970.
A lot of guys that came home were told to take their uniforms off in civilian. I didn't have any civilian clothes, so I wore my uniform. And I was proud to wear my uniform. Damn because right. My country sent me over there, and I did the best that I could do. You know, I to this day, I don't have any regrets about it.
War is a very unpopular thing to be in and start with. But then you have to let all of your personal feelings and attitudes go away because you're a warrior. And that's your job on this earth, is to win for the United States of America.
Each pin on this map marks the location of an attack on Black Americans and their communities from the Civil War into the 1900s. It's no accident you're unlikely to find many of these in American history textbooks. There's been a concerted effort to whitewash and cover many of them up. But while some of the stories may have been scrubbed from the records and textbooks throughout history, survivors and their descendants are speaking out, shedding light on the violent events that took place in their communities and exposing the lingering social and economic damage caused by some of the worst racial violence in American history. After the American Civil War, the country entered a period known as Reconstruction, during which it set about reintegrating the Confederate States and nearly 4 million newly freed enslaved people. But African Americans were hardly given a foundation on which to build their new lives after the war. No reparations were paid to the formerly enslaved for what they and their families had endured for generations. Many had been told they'd be given a small plot of land to get started on. And while there were plans to allocate some land to the formerly enslaved after the war, such as Special Field Order No. 15, much of the land seized by Union forces or promised to African Americans was later given back to white Southern citizens, ex-slave owners, and to white Northern entrepreneurs. The following decade saw African Americans slowly gain more economic and political power. They bought land, started businesses, and built schools. But in many places where African Americans succeeded, white Americans set out to destroy that success.
The Civil War was a revolution. It destroyed the most powerful slave-owning class in the world. And now the question is, what's going to replace it? The freed people had a clear understanding of what their freedom meant. They wanted self-determination. They wanted to reconstitute their families. They wanted to live as far away from white people as they could. They basically wanted to be left alone. But they also wanted to be citizens, and they wanted to exercise the rights that other citizens did. And so on some level, Reconstruction was designed to answer this question about the meaning of freedom. And so African Americans became citizens. Slavery's abolished with the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment nationalizes citizenship and creates due process. And so now black people have equal protection before the law, and they can now run for office, hold office, and participate in society. It succeeded for a brief time that it existed. Black people were running for election, they were holding office, there were integrated schools. We were beginning to act and behave like a democracy. By 1877, as the North tires of Reconstruction, we see the withdrawal of troops, and on some level, really, the withdrawal of federal protection of black people's rights. Just because the federal government said Reconstruction was over did mean that black people stopped living their lives like free people. They continued to hold office. They continued to form these very important biracial political parties and movements. They joined interracial unions. They began to own businesses, some cases owning land. Extraordinary success in the face of a lot of violence and not much federal protection. But what happens in the 1890s is that the Southern elite decides for themselves what the meaning of freedom is going to be. They're going to strip black people of their citizenship. White supremacy is reconstituted in the 1890s. It can't look the same as it did in slavery. And so what you end up with is disfranchisement and segregation and sharecropping and convict labor and debt peonage. But underwriting that is extraordinary violence and terror.
I like this phrase that sociologists and historians often use to describe the country in terms of race relations. And that is that this was a period they described as the nadir of race relations in America, the low point of race relations in America. And they use that language because there was this proliferation of these events that were called race riots that were mainly assault on black communities. It was in New York and Philadelphia, Baltimore and Memphis and Omaha and Chicago and DC. Summer and fall of 1919 was dubbed by James Weldon Johnson, who was with the NAACP, as Red Summer. Red is a metaphorical reference to blood that flowed through the streets from all this violence post-World War I. The other thing that's happening during this period is lynching. Lynching is simply a form of domestic terrorism aimed more often than not at black folks. The real aim is to strike fear in the hearts and minds of a group, black folks in this case, to make sure that black folks knew and stayed in their place. And so lynching was running rampant during this period.
The Elaine that we see today is very different from the Elaine at the time of the massacre. At the time of the massacre, it was one of the fastest growing cities and local economies in the state.